In one of his songs, Stephen Sondheim called New York the city of strangers. That anonymity of the city may be one of its greatest draws, but could there be something about urban spaces that brings strangers together? Is there something about the Big Apple that makes it a particularly romantic place? In Heart of the City, Nine Stories of Love and Serendipity on the Streets of New York, National Book Critics Circle Award winner Ariel Sabar has compiled true tales of nine ordinary couples from the 1940s to the present, whose matchmaker was the city of New York. It's published by DeCapo Press, and I'm very pleased that it brings Mr. Sabar to our show today. Hello.
Hi.
When we think of romantic cities, it's Paris or Rome, Venice that come to mind, not New York City. But wasn't it seen as a great place for people to meet in the movies of the 30s, 40s, and 50s? And then something changed.
Well, absolutely. I mean, there is this long history, and I think maybe beginning in the 30s, but all the way up to Sex and the City and just about every sort of Woody Allen movie, that there were these sort of fictional romances set in New York. It was a very romantic place. And I mean, in a way, I even view King Kong as a story of unrequited love that takes place at a New York City landmark. But what hasn't really been done, or what I couldn't really find, was sort of a real-life analog to all of that. I mean, we knew it happened in the movies, but did people actually meet by chance in New York City? And that was the sort of inspiration for this book.
Well, did this grow out of thinking about your parents for your previous book, My Father's Paradise, the one that won the National Book Critics Circle Award?
Absolutely.
They met in Washington Square Park?
In Washington Square Park. These were two people who, by all rights, had no business meeting each other. My father was born to an illiterate mother in a mud shack in the mountains of Kurdish Iraq. And my mother was the daughter of a Manhattan CEO and his opera-loving wife. I mean, I have these images of the two of them. While my father's parents were probably like crossing a river on donkeys, my mother's parents were at the Metropolitan Opera, you know, fanning themselves with programs. People who are just so different. And then somehow they find themselves in this park in 1966, and my father works up the courage to speak to her.
But I would think that Washington Square Park is a place where a lot of people meet because NYU is there, and people tend to talk to each other more in places like that than they might in other places. It's harder to strike up a conversation in the subway or in some of the places that you also write about, Central Park or the observation deck at the Empire State Building.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things I asked my father was, you know, I sort of drilling down on this story. Well, how did you sort of feel in the park? And, you know, my father grew up in a small town in the mountains of Iraq. And, you know, New York was a very intimidating place for him. It felt overwhelming. It was overstimulating. And I said, well, what was it about the park? And he said, Washington Square Park brought the city down to a human scale. People who felt unapproachable on the street suddenly felt familiar inside the sort of confines of the park and like family, he put it. And I think, in fact, when I grilled him on this, I said, so where was it exactly that you saw Mom for the first time? And he said, actually, I saw her on the street. And I said, wait a second. So if she had never entered the park, you never would have worked up the courage to talk to her? And he said, basically, yes, Ariel. And the reason was that he felt it was improper in the sort of the screaming rush of Manhattan sidewalk to approach somebody who he found interesting. Only within this sort of sanctuary of the park did he have the feeling that he could do that.
Do you think this is still happening? Because in your book, public spaces play major roles, Central Park, Grand Central Terminal, museums, Times Square. But today, don't most of the city's love affairs begin not on the streets but online?
You know, that's a very good point. And one of the things that I encountered when I was looking for prospecting for couples, I called priests, wedding photographers, rabbis in New York City pleading for leads, for stories. Are there any couples that you've married recently who met in iconic public spaces in New York? And they said, gosh, if you had asked me 20 or 30 years ago, I would have had dozens for you. Now, more and more are meeting online. And I think that, you know, I wonder about that. I wonder whether something is lost.
Well, it's also hard to strike up a casual conversation to somebody who has an iPod in his or her ears.
That's a very, very good point. I think we are paying less attention to sort of the actual agora, you know, sort of the Greek sense of this, or the public square, and are more absorbed in these, you know, glowing devices that command our attention instead of paying attention to the humanity that's around us at all times. We just have to open our eyes.
Do you think that the city planners thought about this when they were putting the city together?
You know, I think they actually didn't think about it. I mean, my understanding of the sort of the architectural history of the city of New York is that the planners thought, well, you know, it's an island. It's surrounded by water. We don't need public spaces. If people need to get some fresh air, they can walk to the the riverfront and take in the air there. We don't want to waste space. And I think that that started to change as New York's profile in the world rose.
So how did you collect the stories in your book?
Well, I was a daily journalist for many, many years, and I sort of resorted to all the tricks of the trade, everything from posting on blogs, on Craigslist, calling priests, rabbis, wedding photographers. I scoured newspaper archives. I looked through decades and decades of wedding announcements, searching for stories that would fit this kind of crazy, admittedly sort of crazy criteria, which is that the couple had to have met by chance in an iconic public space in New York City and had to have gotten married.
Well, you only have nine, and all of them are straight couples.
Yes, yes.
A gay member of my staff asked why wouldn't he also have a gay meeting?
Oh, and a very fair question. I'll say at the outset that we made a great effort to find a gay couple, everything from, again, posting on blogs to calling national gay media organizations saying we really want a committed same-sex couple in the book. Not that that's an excuse, but in the end, despite many efforts, we were not able to work find someone who was willing to be in the book.
My guest is Ariel Sabar, whose latest book is called Heart of the City, Nine Stories of Love and Serendipity on the Streets of New York. It is published by DeCapo, and we have gotten a comment on our show page from Heidi in Manhattan, who said, I met my boyfriend of 5 years while shooting the Bergdorf Goodman's Christmas windows. I've been shooting the Christmas windows around the city for the past 15 years and finally met someone who shares the same passion.
That's wonderful.
That's the kind of story you're talking about here.
Absolutely.
But you go back all the way to the 40s.
Yes, yes.
How did you find the story about Joey, the runaway, and Willis, the sailor from Texas who met in Central Park on the eve of World War II?
Well, I was mucking around in the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C., looking at old newspaper stories. And sure enough, in the 1940s, there's just story after story in all the major New York papers and nationally about this couple who meet in Central Park. He's this dirt poor Texas sailor who literally has something like 24 hours on liberty in New York. He goes out to Central Park because Central Park was a place where people who didn't have a lot of money would go. And he finds this young runaway whose father had just died, whose mother had sort of abandoned her. And he strikes up a conversation with her as she's trying to light a cigarette under a bridge abutment in Central Park. And I was just blown away. I mean, it became this sort of cause célèbre. I think Benny Goodman struck up the band at the New Yorker Hotel for their wedding. David O. Selznick, the great movie producer, had expressed interest in making a movie about their story. And, you know, one of the criteria I had was the couple, at least one of the spouses, still had to be alive. And I'm thinking, you know, they were teenagers or 1920 in 1941. There's no way. Enter Google. I put Willis's name in Google, and sure enough, a little bio pops up on the internet. He's apparently now selling nutritional supplements in Southern California, which is, I guess, what people do there. And his little bio, the age on the bio matched perfectly. And I emailed him, and I said, by any chance, are you the same Willis Lankford who was in this story back in 1941? And he wrote back a few days later saying, yes, I am indeed the same party. And I was thrilled. His wife, unfortunately, Joey, although they remained married for something like 60 years, had passed away a few years before.
So he just offered her dinner. They lived happily ever after, but not in New York.
Not in New York.
You wrote in your introduction, the couples in this book hail from across America and the world. Most don't live in New York City. Some never did. What mattered to me was that they met there in one of the iconic public places.
And I think that speaks to its magic, that you don't have to live here. In fact, I think New York reserves some of its sort of fiercest effects for visitors I think the folks who live here in a way become accustomed to things that perhaps they tune out some of its wonder. I worry about that sometimes. But, I think, and Joan Didion has a wonderful quote about this in one of her essays about New York, how, you know, living in New York can risk you sort of reducing the miraculous to the mundane. And I think for people who are here for only a few days, it remains miraculous.
Do you think things have changed or changed anyway when New York got the reputation for being a city where there was a lot of crime? Because I know that when I see people looking at a map, for example, and I go over and offer to help, they often jump back. In fact, I've even heard that there are guidebooks that warn you not to talk to the locals.
Interesting. Well, I wonder about that. I think a lot of people mistake, and there is this mask, there is this armor that New Yorkers wear. And I think that it's for me, it seems more a sort of a physiological reaction to just how stimulating the urban environment is. I don't think it's hostility. And I think, in fact, one of the things I talk about in the introduction of the book is this social psychology research into how it is that strangers behave in public spaces. And one of the most consistent findings over decades and decades of studies is that density matters, that the closer any two people are together, whether it's in a classroom, on a neighborhood street, or in an office, the more likely they are to become friends and even to think well of one another. So I think if you stop the New Yorker on the street and say, what do you think of that guy over there? They probably think, well, they're all right. Because living in New York, I think, makes you family, whether you've said a single word to someone else. And I think the reason for that is the sheer sort of demands that the city makes on its inhabitants and on its visitors.
Well, some of the places you talk about are favorite tourist spots, but if you want to meet a New Yorker, you probably shouldn't go to the observation deck of the Empire State Building unless you want to meet somebody who's showing friends from out of town around. Another place that most real New Yorkers rush through, avoid altogether, is Times Square. But you did find that as a setting for romance. Of course, it was a cop who had to be there.
He was a beat cop and had been divorced and was sort of cynical about relationships. And sure enough, this young Minnesota college girl who was in town researching an architecture thesis on 9/11. She was going to attempt to design a museum and memorial, even though, you know, she lived in Fargo, North Dakota at the time. And, of course, that was a subject of conversation between them. But here in this place that people tend to sort of write off as sort of being sort of Disneyfied or whatever, there are still these magical everyday moments that I think, you know, you have to open yourself to. It does take a certain amount of vulnerability in a way. If you're completely closed off to your surroundings, no, this isn't going to work. But if you're able to recognize those sparks and to venture something, clearly, I mean, I don't want to pretend that it always works out, but you have to be willing to venture something. And I think remarkable public spaces can give prospective couples kind of a push.
Well, the Metropolitan Museum of Art, for example, or any museum, because people, strangers, are willing to talk about what they're looking at.
And you've hit on another key point from the research. William White, who did a bunch of studies, pedestrian movement studies in New York City in the 1970s, trying to figure out why some Midtown Manhattan plazas were flooded with people and why others were barren, discovered this phenomenon he called triangulation, which is basically you need to give people something to talk about. You need to give them a spectacle of some kind, an object that sort of binds strangers. Even if they have nothing in common, they suddenly have this shared experience. And so you can imagine walking into a museum where there's a beautiful piece of art and suddenly you're looking at someone else who's also noticing it. And then you have this connection. You have something to talk about that isn't each other. And I think that lowers the bar for communication.
Well, a number of the stories are about people asking for directions. How do I get to Chinatown? The next thing you know, they're getting married.
Right. There is a lot of that. And one of the themes, of course, in the book is that the way in which New York has played this historic role as sort of a gateway for immigrants, where people of every conceivable stripe find each other.
Lucia in Brooklyn writes, I was living in Staten Island a few years ago when I met my fiancé commuting to Manhattan on the Staten Island Ferry. I used to sit and read, often smiling over the shouts and murmurs column in The New Yorker, and would notice him looking at me every now and then. After a few months,
wow,
he worked up the courage to approach me. We're getting married in May.
Wonderful. Congratulations. I mean, that just sort of encapsulates so much of what this book aims for.
As I see it also as a reminder of why we must care about the design of urban spaces.
Most definitely. I think we have a tendency in this country to sort of privatize, to mollify. And New York is lucky in that it still has these very, very vibrant public spaces. And you know, organizations like the Municipal Arts Society of New York or the Project for Public Spaces, you know, God bless them, because they're out there making sure that these places continue to function as gathering places, as engines of democracy with a lowercase d, as breeding grounds for community, to remind us that, you know, all of us, although we come from these different places, we look different, we have different preferences, we're all sort of bound by something human.
Well, are we helped by the fact that, as William White pointed out, this is a pedestrian city, and many other cities are not? It's really hard to meet somebody when you're driving.
I grew up in Los Angeles. I know exactly how that works. I mean, I was born in New York, but had, you know, grew up in LA, and it's a very socially isolating place because people get in their cars inside of garages, just pull out, and then wind up on the freeways. And you know, I'll tell you, you know, even my parents, you know, have barely know their neighbors, and it's sort of a sad commentary on the way in which the landscape can affect in harmful ways our neighborliness and our relationships with one another.
You've inspired a lot of listeners to write in their stories. Rob in Chelsea says, I met my ex, that was another problem, under the Brooklyn Bridge. Both of us were extras in a car commercial. We returned every year that we were together and picnicked there on our anniversary.
Oh, terrific, terrific.
I'm assuming that you're going to do something different for the next book.
Yes, yes. I'm still I'm working on an idea for that. I'm working on a few magazine pieces at the moment, one of which is an outgrowth of this book and the environmental psychology in the book, the researchers who actually study the interplay between environment and behavior.
Ariel Sabar's first book, My Father's Paradise, won the National Book Critics Circle Award for autobiography. He has written for many publications. His latest book is Heart of the City, 9 Stories of Love and Serendipity on the Streets of New York. And he'll be reading and signing books tonight at 7 at the Borders Store on Park Avenue at 57th Street, and then reading and signing books tomorrow night at 6:30 at the Tenement Museum. That's at 91 Orchard Street. And on Wednesday night, he'll be reading and signing at 7 on at the Strand. That's at 828 Broadway at 12th Street. For information about all of these events, visit our show page at WNYC.org. Thank you so much for being with us, Aaron.
Thanks for having me. It was a pleasure.